This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff, and we are now at episode number 71. And I'm very excited to bring to you all today the work of Dr. Molly Andrews. Her work has been very influential on me over this last year. I drew on a lot of her work around narrative and forgiveness. In the presentation I gave at the American Family Therapy Academy conference this summer, and I'm just really excited. These are a lot of ideas that I'm currently wrestling with. I'm writing a paper now that obviously I'm probably going to be citing Dr. Andrews' work quite a lot. I'm writing a paper on rupture and repair in the therapeutic relationship, so hopefully that will see the light of day someday. Anyway, let's just get right into it and chat with Dr. Molly Andrews. So Molly Andrews is a professor of political psychology and the co-director of the Center for Narrative Research at the University of East London. Her research interests include political narratives, the psychological basis of political commitment, political identity and patriotism, and intergenerational dialogue. Her books include Lifetimes of Commitment, Aging, Politics, and Psychology, Shaping History, Narratives of Political Change. Both of those are on Cambridge University Press. And Narrative, Imagination, and Everyday Life, recently on Oxford University Press. She serves on the editorial board of five journals, which are published in four countries. And her publications have appeared in Chinese, German, Swedish, Spanish, Czech, and German. And for the academic year of 2019 to 2020, she is the Jane and Atos Erko Visiting Professor at the Helsinki Collegium for Advanced Studies at the University of Helsinki. I think you're going to be, this is just a great conversation we had, and I'm really looking forward to sharing it with you. So without further ado, let's meet Dr. Molly Andrews. All right, Dr. Andrews, welcome to the Radical Therapist Podcast.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. Thank you for making the time. You're in Helsinki, as I understand it.
That's correct.
Doing some work. And so I really appreciate you making the time. And I should let you know, your work has been very influential to me. Earlier this year, presented at the American Family Therapy Academy conference on rupture and repair in the therapeutic relationship. And in that presentation, I drew a lot on the work that you've done. And I'm still wrestling with some of your ideas that we'll talk about in a bit, like the living guilty conscience and the offended offender and stuff. And so that's been really interesting to me. So I'm really excited to have, I guess this is my way of saying I'm really excited to have you on the show and just get to talk to you for a little
bit. That's really great to hear and to hear that people actually read the stuff you write and think about.
So to get started, I was introduced to your work on narrative, apology, and time, and the moral and ethical boundaries between them. And some of the questions you wrestle with in this work include, who can apologize to whom and for what? Can forgiveness be bestowed on behalf of others who are no longer there? Must forgiveness be preceded by an acknowledgement of wrongdoing? And I'm wondering if you could share more about this work and your interest in it and how this all came to be.
Sure. I'm going to start with a little story.
Great.
What with being a narrative person, but... many years ago, back in 1992, I was lucky enough to be spending some time in Berlin, and I had managed to be able to put together a sort of patchwork quilt of funding to do some research there. And I was living on the floor of a friend's place with her newborn baby, and we were talking to people who had been key activists in the bloodless revolution of 1989. And it took me a while to get to Berlin because I didn't really have a proper grant. And so as fate would have it, I arrived there about 6 weeks after the opening of the Stasi files, the state secret police. And so although I hadn't really intended to go there and to talk about questions of forgiveness, in fact, you can imagine how raw the society was, and people had just begun reading their files and finding out that, you know, some, you know, colleagues, sometimes even spouses had spied on them and all the rest of it. And so I became really interested in how not only do individuals as individuals, but how do societies move past such betrayal, rupture, whatever. So I had very, very good fortune to be interviewing a woman called Katia Hoffman. And Hoffman was herself a really very brave underground activist and part of a small group of women who had been very, very effective in their anti-state political activism. But she was also famously the wife of Robert Hoffman. And Robert Hoffman is sort of the symbol of East German resistance. He's sort of like the Martin Luther King of East Germany, as it were. And her husband was quite a bit older than her. And he actually spent his final years, they spent his final years in, living under house arrest in their home, about 30 miles out of Berlin. I'm not sure if it was 30 miles. Anyway. And so I asked her, anyway, and he died. That's where he died. And so he never tasted the freedom. And so I asked her if she felt that she was able to forgive those people who had robbed her of the final years of being able to be with her husband in any place other than, you know, the four walls of their home. And she turned to me and she just said, oh, no, it really works in quite a different way, actually. It's they, the people who had spied on them and kept them under house arrest, et cetera. She said, it's they who cannot forgive us for what they've done to us. We are the living guilty conscience. And she proceeded to tell me how desperate almost she and others had been to forgive those who had caused them such hardship. And they had really looked forward to these encounters, you know, and thinking that together they would move past this rather horrific past. But that isn't what came to pass, actually. Many of the perpetrators didn't want to be involved in those kind of conversations at all, really resented it, et cetera. So I got involved in this research really from that moment forward. I was utterly fascinated by what she said. I was also appalled by it, I have to say, you know, that this extraordinary woman with such generosity of spirit experienced that. And so it literally was one of those kind of light bulb moments. I spent the next few years thinking a lot about forgiveness and thinking about, well, how does it work in a political context? And I had always been very interested, particularly in South Africa. And only a few years later, you have the, you know, the creation of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is all built on this construct of forgiveness and all that. So I, in fact, then ended up widening my focus to other areas of political rupture. But I was always interested in, well, how does that work? How does a society that's been through these kind of times, how do they move past that? And so that's really that original encounter with Katia Hoffman was sort of what I would call a light bulb moment. I really knew that I would be interested in that for a long time. I also have to mention, this isn't academic thing, but since tomorrow actually starts Yom Kippur, and I'm Jewish, and you know, I'm not. Jews aren't the first or the last to be really fascinated with how does the question of atonement and forgiveness operate in our lives. But it certainly, you know, was very much in the air for me growing up. And but the interesting thing for me was that when I went to do a big literature search on, you know, what has been what's the scholarship that's happened around forgiveness? There was almost nothing that wasn't in the realm of theology or of organized religion, okay? And given that we talk about it so much, and it's like a word that's it's a bread and butter word, we kind of assume it's good, we should be working for it, whatever, it seems strange to me. There was some work, but very little. And the last thing I'll say about that, and then I'll, is that literally just today, I was walking in Helsinki to my workplace, and there was a very colorful kind of billboard with this word, forgive. Had no context. I went up to the thing and I thought maybe there was, some place to donate goods or I thought there would be something, nothing. It was just this big word, forgive. And you see, that to me really is a good example of how this is a word, it's like love or democracy or whatever.
Right.
But I don't think there's a lot of agreement about what it really means or an appreciation of how complex that process really is.
Yeah, we have something going on currently. A police officer who killed an unarmed black man in his own apartment recently was sentenced to 10 years, and the victim's brother in the courtroom.
I saw this.
And that's created quite a stir here on kind of both sides. Like, we don't, you know, black Americans that I follow have been saying, you know, why are we so quick to forgive? And then there's other people on the other side saying we've lost the ability to forgive, you know, because our in the States right now are, you know, there's a very divided country that we have. And I was just wondering, you did say you saw that. I just saw
a very small clip of it on Facebook. So I didn't really get to see the context.
Sure.
And I only saw it last night. But without trying to be, you know, enter into the sort of foray of somebody else's really quite horrific tragedy.
Sure.
It was hard for me as somebody who really didn't know much about the context to really understand what that person, the brother, thought he was doing there, what it actually meant to him. I mean, there are other instances of this as well, where you see, you know, like in Northern Ireland, this daughter dying in her father's arm, and he says, you know, Father, forgive them, they know not what they are doing. And he's been heralded as this great, you know. And I can understand why people want to, you know, can say, well, that's a really wonderful thing that they can do. But I don't think that we really question enough, what does that actually mean? What is it that they are doing? Okay. And people present me, for instance, with all sorts of arguments about why, what this is what I would call unilateral forgiveness, about why, in other words, you don't actually need, as far as I'm aware with that brother, for instance, he had no real encounter with the policeman. The policeman didn't really... That would alter what I'm saying. But let's just say that if it is just on his side, okay, as it was with the father whose daughter was dying in his arms, he didn't have any kind of engagement whatsoever with the people who had shot and killed her, and he just forgave them. Well, there's lots of reasons why people want to forgive and perhaps feel that they are forgiving, but I think a lot of it, and when you read about it, there's something like it's about a release for the human spirit, that you're no longer, that you're not tied to that and blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be judgmental of those people who do that. But I have to say, in fact, on this Facebook thing, I didn't respond at all. It was quite a good friend of mine, actually, who had posted this. And I thought, I don't want to get into this.
Mm.
But actually, my friend was just like, isn't this incredible? And I was like, well, it depends. What is it that you think he's doing there? You know, and wouldn't it be, I mean, what I think is much more incredible. No, that sounds judgmental of the brother. I don't feel that way. But what is incredible to me is when people have been victims themselves, or they are family members of victims of violence, and they nonetheless dedicate themselves to engaging with the perpetrator, finding out what has happened with them, and actually engage in a dialogue over time. Not that they should have to forgive them, but that they work to understand how bad things happen. Okay. Mm. That's much more, if you will, dialogic.
Yeah. I was going to say relational in some way.
Yeah. And to me, that actually moves us in a direction that is a direction I want to go in. Okay.
Yeah.
And that I think is more because I also think it's important, without trying to sound like I'm on a high horse or something, I think it's important for the moral order that people be made accountable for what they do.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. And even if it feels really horrible inside not to forgive someone, I think that we need to disentangle words like reconciliation and forgiveness. Okay. When you have the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, that's a problem. Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, although I have many wonderful things to say about it, but these are two things, you know, truth and reconciliation. These are difficult to put together. And then when you throw forgiveness in there, it's like, really? They have to forgive now too? You know, based on what? So I think that, I think that for me, the work that I'm trying to talk about and that I'm more interested in is the one that actually requires, if you want to use words like victim and perpetrator, I don't use them myself that much, but who work which brings together the person who has suffered with the person who has caused the suffering.
Right.
And for them to try to find a way forward together. Yeah.
What I mentioned. That's great. Thank you for that. And I'm wondering, while you were talking too, I'm wondering if you had some ideas about how, because your work identifies the paradox of the offended offender, in which an offender who does not contest the reality of their offenses nevertheless feels offended in the enumeration of grievances, which leads to the question of forgiveness then becoming inverted. Can the offender forgive the offended for offering forgiveness, which has produced negative feelings in the offended? And I know that's a lot, and it ties in with the guilty living conscious. And I wonder if you could say more about this dilemma.
Yes. I'm not sure that in this idea, and I'm not the first person to write about that, obviously, but I'm not sure that in this construct of the offended offender, that they necessarily do acknowledge that they've done wrong. I mean, there's like there's the twisted moment in the book David Copperfield when Uriah Heep turns to David and says, "David, I forgive you." Okay, which is just so warped, you know, and it brings in this question like who and I mean, it's just a breathtaking moment, you know, like what you forget. But we know in our daily lives that happens as well. And there is nothing so precious as somebody who offers you forgiveness. Okay. When you feel that you have been the one who has been so wronged. Mm-hmm. Okay. So in a sense, from their point of view, perhaps, you know, I am then putting myself in the place of the person who's the offended offender. When someone offers you forgiveness, they are saying you are someone who needs forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Okay. You have done this thing. And in the case of like Katya Hoffman, where she, again, back to that original story, when she's talking about being the living guilty conscience, the very desire on her part and the part of others who share her position to be so open to these talks of forgiveness, what they are doing by that is placing those people who have done them such harm into a position where they have to acknowledge the the deep hurt that they have caused. They don't want to do that. They don't want to do that. And in that paper of mine that you read, I make a point about the difference, the really important difference between what we call, you know, apologies and the sort of Greek term apologia, which actually stems from the idea of justification or explanation. One of the things that's, you know, can make people not only frustrated, but actually really angry is when they think that someone is going to apologize to them. The person offers up as if they are going to apologize. And instead, they come forward with a justification, an explanation, not a, I am sorry. I am sorry, but the situation called, that doesn't work so well. Okay. And that's how that dynamic of that offended offender, I think, comes in as well. Because people who are, you want to understand how it was that somebody did something. Of course, you want to enter into their worldview. But that's quite different from actually trying to explain away what they did. Okay. You sort of accept the action or whatever the condition was, you try to understand it, and from that you move on. But you don't actually, as the person who's in the role of the wrongdoer, you don't try to then say, you know, if you were in my position, you would have done it too, or whatever. And that's been the problem in, for instance, in East Germany, where more than 9 times out of 10, people who come forward with ostensibly what would be apologies, they're in fact justifications. And that's why that process has been so fraught.
Right. And do you see this kind of this dynamic playing out more often than not these days? And I'm thinking of the offended offender, the kind of the guilty living conscience. Do you see it getting in the way of more productive conversations when harm has taken place? And or do you have some ideas of what gets in the way of apology?
Yeah, I think that I don't know about, you know, does the offended offender, is that happening, as you say, you know, more often than not? I'm not sure about that. Right. But what I do think is that we're not really that well socialized or trained up to genuinely listen to one another, to actually try to take seriously another person's point of view, as difficult and as different from yours as it might be. And one of the things that I think needs to be in place for a genuine apology to both be offered and received is a platform which involves parties actually being able to listen to each other, okay? Mm-hmm. And we're not very good at that, or that's what I think. Mm-hmm. And in my work with political forgiveness, the context is often, you know, so fraught, so politically charged that, by the way, if you do actually confess to doing something, you know, the impact of that could be severe for your long-term future, for your family, for your job prospects,
right.
You know. So there are real implications for that. Now, in East Germany, the people like Katia Hoffman fought absolutely valiantly for there to be as minimally charged an environment as possible so that those conversations could happen. But, you know, ultimately, that isn't the case. Ultimately, the context is the wider, you know, West German environment in which East Germans are, you know, all East German university professors had to apply for their jobs again, right? Well, I mean, if they're at the same time talking about their work with the Stasi, that's not really going to help them get a job. Okay, so all of these things are really tied in together. I don't want to say that, you know, apologies and the question of forgiveness is exactly the same between individuals as it is between people in politically charged environments. But I think there are many aspects which carry over into both dimensions of that.
Yeah, and I might ask, I'm going to ask you about that in a second, but I'm going to ask, you also write about windows of opportunity for apology, and that I'm quoting you, I forgive as I ask for forgiveness. And I'm wondering if you could say more about these windows of opportunity and that idea of forgiving as I ask for forgiveness.
Okay. The windows of opportunity, I mean, I need to stick pretty closely with the stuff that I really do know about, because otherwise I'll be tempted to go off into just my own ideas.
You're allowed.
The windows of opportunity really have a lot to do with the political context, for instance, in East Germany. Mm. So when there is the possibility for someone who has spied on another person to actually talk to that person and they don't, is there a time after which it's too late? You missed your opportunity. Mm-hmm. And there is not there's not real agreement on this issue. Some people say, you know what? You can go to your grave with your guilt. I don't want to hear it. You missed it, actually. And I've encountered some pretty brutal stories about that, but I also understand it because, you know, for people who feel that they dedicated themselves to setting the table so that this genuine dialogue could happen, and then the person or persons still don't come forward, well, you know, how long do you keep that table set? Okay. But some other people say, no, you know what? You can do so till your dying day. It is never too late. So I have spent more time kind of trying to document the landscape on that temporal dimension rather than coming down myself on it. I've just tried to listen to what people feel about that. Hmm. And what did you say? I forgive as I ask for forgiveness. Now, that really comes from this whole South African idea of Ubuntu, which is a word you maybe know as well, right, which is about recognizing the humanity in everyone. And actually the really important, critical orientation that says that when you are going to engage in such a dialogue, that you actually recognize that humanness in the person with whom you are speaking, as you want them to recognize that in you. So a lot of that work, for instance, in prison work these days, which, you know, has my brother has been involved in some of that work, which, you know, has victims of crime meeting the person who perpetrated them. The idea that they can actually meet that person and find out about their lives and all that rest of it. You're also trying to get them to engage with the life of the person who you've hurt. Okay. It facilitates them recognizing what they've done and the effects of their action. But it's also really important, I think, if you're going to try to invite someone into a conversation like that, that you don't keep them forever boxed in as this person who committed this crime. It's sort of like, I mean, I'm not really particularly religious, but it's, you know, hate the sin, but love the sinner. Mm-hmm. There is something in that, so that you really commit yourself to not only recognizing, but holding on to the humanity of the person that you're speaking.
Great. I have in that presentation I did, after talking about this part, I moved into how do you make an apology? Or I kind of did it amends rather, making an amends rather than an apology. And I drew on 12-step like folk wisdom that they use. around, you know, naming it, naming the harm done, creating some space for allowing people to share how that made them feel or experience, and then asking, what can you do to right the wrong, and then doing that, right? So I borrowed that from the 12th step, and I know I have a lot of people probably listening that work with people and relationships and stuff like that, and I'm sure you get asked this all the time. Do you have some ideas about how repair happens, or apology, or what have you seen to be effective? What would you recommend to therapists or counselors or social workers, whatever?
I don't know that I would recommend anything, but I'll give you some of my thoughts.
Sure.
I think that for me, this question of acknowledging wrongdoing is really, really important. And it takes a lot of work for people to get to that. And I think that, like the Eastermans, who I've done this research with, but other people as well, people need each other. The person who has been hurt and the person who has inflicted the hurt, they need each other in this to, in a sense, move past this. And that's really, really hard work for both parties. But I think it depends on people, one, being able to listen to each other and being able to trust that the other person is going to, I mean, there's many reasons why you might not want to trust somebody who's done so wrong by you, but trust that they are at least with you in that engagement there, okay? And as I say, as where we started out, I think an absolutely critical part of that is that they acknowledge what they have done. Hmm. They acknowledge it. They do not try to explain it away. They express remorse, okay? Because one of the things which is really problematic is this idea that you can simply just say that you did it and that it's supposed to be that, you know, forgiveness flows. No, you're never owed forgiveness. It's something you can ask for and that can happen, but there's no guarantees on that. And just the idea that by just simply stating that you've done this thing, I mean, that can have some horrendous dimensions as well, as you probably have heard, you know, in the amnesty hearings in South Africa and the TRC, where people were not required to express remorse for good reason. Okay. I have to say, you can't require someone.
Impose it on people. Right.
You can, yeah. It's like a King Lear thing. You know, you can't do that, but when they don't have to do that, and some people told me it almost comes off as if they're bragging, right? I did this, I did this, I did this, I did this, and now I get my amnesty. That does not actually move us down the road towards forgiveness, okay? It does other things which are needed. So family gets information that they need about where their loved one's remains lie or whatever, but it certainly doesn't move us down the road towards forgiveness. So I think for forgiveness, you need to be able, you need two parties who are willing to engage and willing to do that hard work together. And you need for each party to try to understand the other, okay? And that also really requires very much so that the wrongdoer acknowledges what they've done.
Yeah, great. Okay, thank you for all of that. Now, kind of moving into your more recent work, you're exploring narrative imagination in everyday life, and in the newer work, as I understand it, you examine the intricate link between our ability to tell stories and our capacity to envision future and past, the not real and the not yet real, and the worlds of other people. And the theme of this work is that narrative and imagination has steeped into all corners of our existence. And I'm wondering if you could say more.
Yeah, I guess I would rephrase that a little bit. I don't know that I would say that narrative and imagination have seeped into all corners of our existence, but rather that they frame them. And so that when we think about narrative, people tend to think about stories of people telling things, the real, as it were. But actually, when you're telling a story about something that happened, or when you're telling about a dream or for the future, you're always actually incorporating some elements and not others. And so what's really critical is when you are, for instance, telling a story about your past, that you, that your audience can actually somehow fundamentally take in the idea that the present was not always inevitable, that at one point in time, it was just one of many, many outcomes that could have happened. And so our imagination, in a sense, has to go, what I say, time traveling. Okay. Mm-hmm. We have to go back into a time. It's hard to, for whatever, talking to people about, you know, pre 9/11. Okay. It's very, very hard to actually say, no, some of the things that you are taking for granted about the world as we, as it operates now, were not always so. And it wasn't actually necessarily the case that it would have been so. Okay. And so that actually requires a narrative imagination that goes backwards in time to reimagine a different present. Okay. Similarly, if you, and for instance, in political work, you know, political work is not just about calling out the outrageous stuff that happens in the present day. It's also hopefully about trying to envision a different kind of life as it might be, or equally, it could be inspired by imagining the nightmare, you know, of what, the you know, of shooting immigrants in the legs as they try to come across the border. Okay, we don't think it could get much worse, but you know what? Use your narrative imagination. That nightmare, if it's not put in check, could. So these questions about what stories we tell and don't tell, and how they actually fit in the context of other stories, both of things that have happened and things that haven't happened, are really critical. Now, just a word, that the phrase, the real, the not real, and the not yet real, actually comes from Sartre. And it was his own work, which was very much based on imagination as well. And that's from Being in Nothingness, okay? And he says that this actually, our ability to imagine, okay, is actually the basis of our freedom. And I think that that's true. It's also, but it's not just imagination in this way, in this rosy way we tend to think of it, because I think we also need to employ it when we think about the dangers in the future that we would like to avert.
All right, thank you. Okay, in this work, you come at it as a researcher, but I'm wondering for our therapist counseling audience, if you could share on the role that magic has played in your own life and how you tackle the challenge that researchers and therapists and counselors face to immerse themselves in a world very different than their own.
Yeah.
It's a big question.
I mean, I've spent a lot of time talking to people whose life worlds are really, really different to my own. And because I'm not a historian, although a lot of historians sort of take up the stuff that I've done, I kind of swim in that pond a little bit, but I'm not a historian. I'm a psychologist. And so I don't really have to get deep into the business, like, is what they are saying true? Okay. Sometimes you can hear stories that are so horrific, you know, that you think, God, you know, did that actually happen? And Erica Applebaum has written some wonderful stuff on the risks of listening. What does it actually mean to take seriously the idea that, yes, this could happen? This could happen. This did happen. Not only that it could happen, but that it did happen to this person. And that's a real challenge when you hear somebody trying to invite you into a world that you, that is really distant to your own. Okay. Now that's quite different from when somebody says, you know, whatever, I have this glass and I dropped it and then it flew, you know, really. I mean, there's some things that you're not willing to go the distance with. You think, well, you're being metaphorical here or whatever. And actually last week when I was away, I had to, I gave a paper on the future for moral education, the challenges for moral education in a post-truth world. Mm. So that's where I'm being taken to task really with that. So in a world where our president lies on average 23 times a day, and we know that certain verifiable things are not, they're just not true. And they're not alternative facts, they're lies, right? So what does that mean? I'm not willing to enter into that, if you want, magical world where those things aren't true. So I think we have a challenge then, and somebody like me has a real challenge to decide, well, which are the kinds of things that you're willing to entertain as being plausible, likely, and indeed quite possibly real. I'm going to move forward as if this is real. And what are the things I'm going to call out and say, no, that's not true. Okay. And I think that that is a challenge for a lot of us.
Right.
And it's not very, you know, there's no easy answer with that, but I think so therefore I'm putting my own argument in a sense in check as well and say, well, I'm not willing to go endlessly down that road, and truth and truthfulness and verifiability do matter. Okay. But that should not block us from being able to say, even while I am always only myself, and the best I can do, Chris, when I want to try to understand something you're saying is to say, well, if I were you, which I will never be, okay, but nonetheless, to try to have my imagination go traveling, mm-hmm. okay, and to entertain the idea that really different things do happen to other people, okay. And that's a really, really, again, an important thing for us to do, but not a skill that we are often encouraged to develop very much.
Right, right. Yeah, thank you for that. And I think, yeah, that return to truth and morality, and I imagine this kind of segues in maybe to my next and really final question. And that's this idea of, like, what ideas are you working on now? What books, et cetera, are capturing your attention at this time?
Well, I have right now the really good fortune of a gift of a year that I'm spending in Helsinki. I'm a visiting professor at the Collegium for Advanced Studies, and these guys, I want to say, really support the work I'm doing, intellectually, scholarly, financially. And so that means, for instance, that next month I'll be spending the first 10 days in Berlin actually re-interviewing some of those people again. So let's see if they've moved on and at all.
Yeah,
forgiveness. One of the things I haven't talked about here, which is fine, I don't need to talk about everything, but is also a lot of work that I have done on reimagining aging. So not only political realm, but also what happens to our ideas of the life course, our own lives, all this hyper truncation of the stages of life, where it's like as if we've never been kids and we can never imagine ourselves as being old. We're only, it's this intense presentism, if you will, where we other young people and we other old people, whatever age we're not, we other, right? Mm-hmm. And that to me is a lack of imagination. It's really incredible. So I'm quite interested in that. I've been doing some work on that. And that actually also ties in with the political work as well, because, you know, one of the stories that we're told is that political activists are, you know, and idealists are a certain age and then they kind of get over it.
Right.
But in fact, my own work actually shows something very, very different. And I've done a number of studies in different places where people actually continue to, if you will, fight the good fight, to believe that social justice is actually worth the hard slog, if you will. Mm-hmm. But, and that activism actually finds very different manifestations at different times in the life course. So one of the things I've been doing, for instance, with the people in East Germany is saying, okay, well, so, you know, you were, if you will, you know, sort of leading these protests and doing, what are you doing now? Well, I'm an archivist. That's my political work. That's my political activism, you know. Or, I mean, I can tell you lots of different examples. And that to me is actually really, really interesting. So I'm doing that work, and I'm supposed to be, I'm not sure if I'm going to do this or not. I'm supposed to be writing a book this year here, which is on this East German project. Mm. I have been playing with the idea of doing a project instead. This is for us, okay?
Yeah.
Because I might not do it, but doing a project on the Sami, you know, the indigenous people here in the Nordic countries, and who have actually become very, very politicized. This current young generation is really, really politicized. And just two generations ago, that was very, very different. The hard push towards assimilation, not being allowed to speak their own language in schools, et cetera. I mean, it's been a real big change. So I was thinking, I am interested in intergenerational narratives, how people actually come to understand who they are in relation to people who've come before them and people who've come after them. And so that is true in terms of trying to understand revolutionary moments and political change, but it's also true just in terms of trying to understand political identities. I think one of the problems that we have is that we think that we're often very much encouraged to think in this very individualistic sense, even in terms of our social movements,
right.
Like that we're, you know, we're starting things and we don't even borrow from our own history. And we, and to me, that is a problem of a lack of intergenerational dialogue and imagination. And I think that, so my own work sort of keeps coming, circling back to that and thinking about conversations that I want to have, as I say, you know, with those who are older and younger than me.
That's great. Okay, one final question. If people want to find you and find your work or even contact you in some way, how do people find you?
So the best email is the one you reached me on, the UEL one. But actually, I also would like to draw attention to our Center for Narrative Research.
Great.
So that's a good route through to that as well. But in terms of my email, I mean, I have one in Helsinki, but I'm only here for a year. So yeah.
I'll link that audience on the show notes. So you'll have the Center for Research link, and I'll post an email so you can reach out if you need to. Molly, thank you very much for making the time. I know it's late in Helsinki, and I just want to say thank you. I've just been very excited to have this conversation, and it's just great to talk to you.
Well, I really appreciate it.
Wonderful. So thanks again. Well, that's our show. And as always, thanks for listening. And if you could do us a favor, we would very much appreciate it. Please rate and review the show on iTunes or wherever you're listening to this podcast. And I also do a YouTube channel, and I'm looking for people to subscribe to it. If you could go find The Radical Therapist on YouTube, go check out the videos, share them widely, subscribe to the channel. That would be appreciated. I do have a new video in the works on amends versus apology. So it's related to our topic today. So you might be interested in that. So go subscribe so you can see it when it comes out. And of course, we're on all the social medias, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Go find The Radical Therapist all over there. And please, if you could, just share our stuff so it gets out in front of more folks. We would really appreciate it. So as always, I'm Dr. Chris Hoff. This has been The Radical Therapist. Thanks for listening.